CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear a little bit about disability relationships from Louise Maxwell. So, can you tell me a little bit about the work you do in supporting persons with disabilities to find that relationship?
My website is twofold. The main portion of my site is to find relationships, but then others who just wanted to have friends and reach out to people of disabilities if they could find out how they go on with their lives and so on. So I did open it up for them too, but it's a smaller portion. What happens is they find out about me from different places, and mainly online as well. And so how my website works, that is so different from other free disability sites, is that I try very hard to keep scammers off the site, and how I work it is really working very well because I verify everyone who comes on by telephone, and because scammers often use online phone numbers and area codes, mainly from United States, some from Canada as well. And so when I call and talk to them, I may say, is this Cam? And they'll say, no, Cam here. So, of course, I know that it is a scammer trying to get on, all kinds of ways that they try and get on. So I work in different ways. I look up every area code before I make the call, but of course some people move around. So I could tell by different ways, different questions that I ask them, but mainly because they just make up a phone number. They get it, like for example, free online Google phone numbers is one of them, and I don't accept anyone from Google phone numbers. So. And then they join the site. I give them a list of navigations, but I tell each and every one of them, I'm here for you. If you're having trouble getting on, I will call you up and walk you through it.
So
that works very well.
So I'm kind of curious, are there ever any challenges in coordinating it so a person with a disability can get on and make full use and find a relationship, find a friendship?
Well, I've had quite a few who have actually married. My website is not too old, so I'm very happy to be on your program. But I have had members marry within the same city or even outside of their state, the one who has a disability that they're able to travel will travel to the other person's state. And I've even had some between U.S. and Canada get married. I have profiles on here, and so they search the profiles mainly regarding age, and like they give a wide sweep of their age and where they are as well, but then they look at others who are not in the same location, because the beauty of this site is the commonality is the disability, in spite of age, gender, or location. And mainly, they do not look at the same disability. There's no hierarchy here. Because maybe someone with a lesser disability or a different disability will be able to help the other one that is in worse shape to do things.
So I'm kind of curious. In your time, bringing people with disabilities together, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Well, yes, I have a few stories on my website, actually, of people who have met. Some do not like to put their information on like that, but mostly they try and get together. If it's in the same city, it works very well. They may meet in a coffee shop, so it's nice and safe. They may go out of state to meet each other. But before they do this, I always, if they come to me, not all of them come to me, they do this themselves within the profiles. But if they do come into our chat room, they get to know others. Some of them meet in my chat room. Some of them get to know me, and they come to me, and I tell them, do not be too quick at getting together. Get to know each other first on the website, because it's nice and safe. If there's someone that's not right for here, and it's not, then, you know, I may have to delete them if it's not right. If they're off the site, I don't have the ability to do that. So I tell them to ask a lot of questions, and maybe ask it later again, some questions, just to make sure that the answers are the same. And then after that, get on the phone and talk to each other on the phone and then meet up. Of course, there are some people with disabilities that are nonverbal, which is harder, so they have to do it by email, more emails back and forth. But I try and keep them on the site for a while in case anything goes wrong, then I could do something about it.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from autism advocate Tiffany Richard. So if you could introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your work, that'd be great.
Okie dokie. My name's Tiffany. I'm a disability self-advocate. I also run a group called the Autistic Penguins.
So when it comes to your advocacy, what sorts of improvements to the disability community are you looking at creating?
Well, I'm on the board of the Acadiana Autism Society in Louisiana, and we do things like we do fundraisers like the Walk of Hope, and we also do an Egg Your Yard fundraiser where we try to raise money and stuff. But we also do programs to try to help educate the public about autism, like the safety program to try to train law enforcement and to know about what autism is and how to interact with us, because a lot of law enforcement don't really know how to interact with us. We also do water safety classes to help train autistic people to learn how to swim. But besides that, I also was a part of the LIN program, which is like a self-advocacy program in New Orleans, where you learn how to be a self-advocate, and you learn about policy and advocacy. So you learn about all these different things to help make yourself a better self-advocate.
So, when you mention law enforcement, what do you find is lacking in their understanding of people with autism? What would you like to see added?
I think what's lacking is the fact that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what autism is. A big, wide spectrum. And there's a lot of misunderstanding to what autism is for people, like in law enforcement. Because for some of them, when they think of autism, they either think of people that are like a shelving pooper, or they think of people that are like, that are high support needs. There's no middle area, and for a lot of people, both of those types of people can't be in the same photo for some reason. It's important for law enforcement to understand that autism, like you meet one autistic person, you met one autistic person, we're all different, and we are all not the same, you know, with our support needs and stuff.
So, what methods are you using to advocate for groups like law enforcement to better understand autism?
We do a seminar every year. The Autism Society does a seminar every year where we invite law enforcement to come over and also firefighters and stuff to listen to a speaker, explain what autism is, how to interact with us, what works best for us. And we also have other self-advocates get involved to answer questions, too, that law enforcement might have to help give them a better understanding of us from our perspective, but also letting us, like, get that interaction with them.
So, in your time advocating for folks with autism, has there been any success story or moment that stands out for you?
I think for me, one success moment was when I was awarded the Vicki Nettles Award last year. Basically, the Vicki Nettles Award is given to somebody in Acadiana if they are a successful advocate, you know, for disability rights and stuff.
So, what are some of the biggest challenges in being a self-advocate?
And some of the biggest challenges are trying to get to people, like help people understand, you know, where you're coming from. Like, for example, like, there's a big barrier between autistic people and neurotypicals. Like, trying to with neurotypicals trying to understand where we're coming from and where we're coming from, trying to understand where we're trying to understand where neurotypicals are coming from. So, I find trying to get my point across, or trying to get what I'm trying to say across the neurotypicals could be tricky in itself, you know?
So, how do you go about getting beyond that? How do you go about finding that common ground?
Well, I read a lot of psychology books, and I try to study human communication as much as I can. And I try to, understand, how neurotypicals communicate and stuff, so I can try to communicate like them and try to get my point across, in a way that they will understand, you know?
So, do you have any advice to those out there who might be starting their own self-advocacy journey?
I say, don't give up. I say, do not give up on the journey. I mean, there's going to be high moments and there's going to be low moments, but don't let the low moments get you down, because we need people to speak out and we need people to push for change in the disability community so that things can be better for future generations.
So, what are the next steps in your work?
The next steps? Well, I am currently on the board. I'm running the group. I think my next steps are going... I'm not sure what my next steps are going to be honest. I never really thought of that. I guess I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing and just try to find other opportunities where I can be a helping voice or a helping hand to help improve disability rights.
So, I'm guessing the ultimate goal would be just acceptance and equality in society.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I'd
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, that sounds good.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Blood donors are needed now as much as ever. If you would like to help meet the needs of patients across Canada, please consider booking an appointment by calling 1-800-2-DONATE. That is 1-800-236-6283, or by visiting blood.ca or through the Give Blood app. The Windsor Blood Donation Centre location is at 3909 Grand Maris Road East. Make a difference with the Canadian Blood Services.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard about disability dating from Louise Maxwell of Soulful Encounters, and we heard a little bit about Tiffany Richards' autism self-advocacy journey. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Joseph Pevsner from the National Organization on Disability. So what can you tell me about your work with the National Organization?
Yeah, so the National Organization on Disability is a 40-plus-year-old nonprofit that focuses on providing equal opportunity for employment for people with disabilities. So we work with government, other nonprofits, and corporate employers to ensure that they employ disability-inclusive hiring, recruiting, onboarding, and employment practices. My work at NOD focuses primarily on our federally funded research and grant work, where we have a couple of really exciting projects under a 5-year grant. And we're known really for our data. We've been collecting employer disability practices data via our tracker survey for going on 12 years now. And we just launched a new tool called the Employee Engagement Survey this year, which collects data from the perspective of employees at participating employers.
So, that being the case, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning disability when it comes to employers' willingness to take them on?
Absolutely. You know, it's a lot of what we do is try to dispel myths and build education, awareness, and understanding to prevent stigmatization of people with disabilities. A couple of very common ones that come to mind, first and foremost, are that people with disabilities are not able to do the job, whatever that job may be. And the reality is, there's some person with a disability that can do any job in existence. Now, that person might need reasonable accommodations to do that job, but you need to, as an employer, give them the tools to be able to complete the task. And when employers are evaluating job applicants, they often think of the disability as a limitation instead of thinking, okay, well, this person has the skills and experience to do the job. What do we need to do to ensure they can do it effectively?
So
that's one that jumps right to the top of my mind. Another very prime example is that people with disabilities might not be there for the long term, right? That their disability may cause them to leave after a short stint of service. The reality is employees with disabilities often have longer tenures than those without. They're far more loyal to their employers because of the commitment that they perceive towards disability inclusion when they get hired, and they're often the strongest advocate of the team and the organization once they have been hired.
So, you mentioned you work with various levels of government. How do you advocate for the best possible practices and management when it comes to employers with working with those with disabilities?
That's a really good question, Ken. You know, the work we do with government spans a few different areas, and I'll focus on two of them primarily. First, NOD launched a policy roundtable a few years back with 16 of the other leading disability-focused nonprofits in America. And in that roundtable, we meet a few times a year to discuss high-priority policy issues and work to lobby on behalf of those policy issues. A couple that have been very high priority over the past few years include the elimination of 14C, which is an employment program that allows employers to pay people with disabilities some minimum wage, sometimes as low as, you know, tens of cents per hour. Now 16 states have repealed 14C, and we're working through the policy roundtable to eliminate it on a federal level. Another large area of focus is increased funding for home and community-based services, allowing people with disabilities to receive care and the support they need in their home or community environment. So the policy roundtable is a really great arm of the organization where we work with other committed NGOs, lobbying both in federal and state settings to affect change in disability employment policy. The second area that I focus on is my work under our research and grant department, where we have a five-year federally funded grant from the National Institute of Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. And that grant really seeks to work with employers to test out new theories and concepts as they relate to disability employment. So in addition to that new employee engagement survey, we're also putting together a randomized controlled trial with our research partners at Syracuse and Rutgers universities and our employer partners to test various interventions as they relate to mental health at work. So through both our policy roundtable and the advocacy we do there, as well as the targeted disability employment research that we conduct through the federally funded grant programs, we're really working with government to both identify the best practices for employers and promote better and new updated policy and regulation to improve conditions for employees with disabilities.
So, in your time with NOD, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
That's a tough question. There's a lot of really good examples. I think, speaking in more broad generalizations, I think the biggest moments of success for me in my work are when I speak with an employer and I speak specifically to an audience of their team members, folks who might not have a previous understanding or commitment to disability inclusion, certainly not to the level that, you know, all the team members here at NOD do. And when we give a presentation and have an engaging discussion with teams that are really, you know, at the starting level of building their disability employment awareness and education, we get phenomenal questions from the audience. And I leave the session knowing that there are people in the audience that took actionable steps from what we shared that they can then use the next day in the way they work both with their colleagues with disabilities and in hiring to promote more disability-inclusive practices. And when I leave those sessions and I see that, you know, people are building that education, that awareness, and that commitment, I see that as a huge success, right? Well, our goal is to directly and indirectly change hearts and minds. And so when I have a really good, engaging session like that, I know that I've done my job. I see that as a huge win.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm clear until 12:55.
Disability dating, my friends, is probably one of the most difficult subjects to touch upon in all of disability life. For in a very true and meaningful way, we must be our own self-advocates when it comes to dating life. In a lot of cases, people assume our disability makes us broken or weaker. This is absolutely not the case. The fact of the matter is, a person with a disability is just as capable of feeling the important things, love and a need for connection, as anyone else. And honestly, it takes certain wisdom to be able to see that side of us. Honestly, sometimes when a person acquires a disability, they may shy away from things like that. They may assume no one will ever see them as worthy. But it all begins with the understanding you are worthy. You do have something to offer in a relationship. You do have something to offer society. And truly, if you don't see it for yourself, how can anyone else be expected to? It begins with recognizing your skills and your gifts. And then, if you're very lucky, you find those with whom you can share it, whether it be just a friend or a colleague or more meaningful, deeper kind of relationship. Fact is, a person with a disability seeks what we all seek, that sense of belonging, that sense of connection, that sense of community. And it is not incumbent upon society as a whole to assume what they want, what they need, what they're capable of understanding. Yes, in some cases, some disabilities would lead to misunderstandings in relationship, and it may come down to a matter of making the choice not to take advantage. That is a very real concern, but by and large, members of the disability community are capable of some connection, some community, some belonging. And I personally am pleased to see an organization working to make that happen. The other side of that coin, however, is, while it's incumbent upon a person with a disability to recognize they have something to offer, it's also incumbent upon society to recognize they can make that decision. They can choose to express those feelings or not express those feelings. We must all play our role in disability relationships. For the fact is, you simply don't choose who you love. You simply feel for whom you feel. And a person with a disability is no different in that sense. We must recognize that we each play a role in relationships. A person with a disability brings their aspect of the relationship. The other participant in the relationship brings theirs. Must be an equal partnership, as it would be with anyone. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.